This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello there, this is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a podcast about making work better. How can we be happier at work? I hope you're well today. I'm Bruce Daisley. Today's guest is regarded as one of the most influential management thinkers in the world, largely because he considers themes and human behaviours that others avoid discussing. Jeffrey Pfeffer is Professor of Organisational Behaviour at the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University. And he's author of books like Management BS, Power, and most recently Dying for a Paycheck. It's the last two books that we mainly discuss in today's chat. His book Power has become a global bestseller, largely because it's a manual for the Machiavellian. It's a modern day version of Niccolo Machiavelli's 16th century book, The Prince. It's not that Pfeffer believes that this is what we should behave like to be our best selves, but rather if we don't behave like this, we're going to be exploited. I was reading through the course notes for Jeffrey's Stanford class on power, and he says that insufficient sensitivity and skill coping with power have cost Stanford graduates promotion opportunities and even their jobs. He says you need to understand these laws of power to get on. Fundamentally, the mistake we're all making, according to Pfeffer, is believing that the world is fair. And I know I'm guilty of this. Whether you watch US politics or British politics, I certainly find myself watching current events thinking a reckoning's going to come when the good guys will win and sort things out. Spoiler alert, the good guys don't win. And the source of that point is history. Jeffrey Pfeffer's belief is that in business, the good guys don't win, so arm yourselves. He believes that leaders often ascend to their position, not through innate goodness, but because they understand the rules of power. Since he wrote it, other authors have jumped on the bandwagon, claiming they've updated his ideas. And after Power, these books like New Power. You'll hear what Jeffrey thinks about that. Now, it wasn't to discuss power that I contacted Jeffrey, but with such a stark take on the world, the conversation does move on to that. I actually contacted him to talk about his brilliant new book that he's published this year called Dying for a Paycheck. In Dying for a Paycheck, he documents how work's killing us and expresses a desire for us to start measuring firms by the harm they do to their employees. A league table of the stresses and the ailments they cause. He wants firms to do good, and the reason why power is relevant is I raise the question that if we believe leaders are innately not thinking of the greater good, when they get on, isn't the fact that firms are doing the same that sort of the consequence of the rules that he championed? We'll discuss that. So that's the reason why I mentioned power, because we do discuss that. Let me set the context for the discussion on Dying for a Paycheck. There's a modern day paradox where visible danger at work has been eliminated. You know, the idea that we might get injured doing our jobs. Meanwhile, the invisible, harmful impact at work has been going up. As we've moved away from the visible workplace dangers, there's a new impact of modern work, and that's stress. Work is the number one cause of stress. When Jeffrey Pfeffer talks about us dying for a paycheck, this is what he means. He gives a story in the book of a worker at Salesforce.com, sort of huge and immensely prestigious San Francisco tech firm. A senior worker at the firm had a baby and found herself under immense pressure 2 weeks after giving birth to come and give a keynote presentation. It's a great honour, she was told. And it's this apparent flattery that sits under a lot of workplace stress that Pfeffer observes. Work's making a series of apparently well-intentioned demands upon us. And these things add up. Black Monday syndrome is the fact that more heart attacks happen on Monday than any other day. Workplace stress is real and increasing. 80% of all workers report stress annually in the UK. These 13.5 million days lost to stress. There's lots of really hidden consequences. His book documents how people are turning to drinking, overeating, other consumptions like drug consumption as a response to workplace unhappiness. A New York Times article he cites said that 21% of lawyers are problem drinkers and 29% report long-term depression. It's Jeffrey Pfeffer's belief that we should try and make these things more visible. We should maybe create league tables of the worst offending workplaces. Now, there are things like this already, and we discuss sites like Glassdoor, which allow workers to review their firms. The issue is that sort of canny employers often game these results, asking the happier workers in their firms to go and post reviews. So Glassdoor can't necessarily be relied upon to describe a workplace accurately. So I hope that gives a context for the discussion. So here's my chat with Jeffrey Pfeffer. One tiny point of context, Jeffrey mentions Twitter, and yet my day job is at Twitter, so that's why he mentions that. I generally try not to discuss myself. Jeffrey, thank you so much for talking to me. There's so much we could talk about. Firstly, I want to talk about Dying for a Paycheck, this new book that you've had out. What made you write this book now?
Well, many things. I've been thinking about writing it for years, and it took me probably too long to do it. But I've sat on the Stanford Committee for Faculty and Staff Human Resources, which is basically a committee that worries about health benefits, for years, and I've watched as Stanford has wrestled with issues of rising healthcare costs, which is a problem really all around the world. Every country is facing rising and soaring healthcare costs. I sat on a committee for Hewitt when it was still independent before it got merged with Aon, in which I watched the leading HR executives from some of Hewitt's largest clients come to these meetings and basically all obsess about only one thing, which was healthcare costs. And as I thought about what companies were doing and countries were doing about healthcare costs, it occurred to me that my intuition was that they were missing one of the biggest sources of the problem, and that source of the problem is the workplace. And so I began with some colleagues looking into this, and the more we looked and the more people I interviewed, the bigger the problem was. So I decided that I needed to write a book that brought attention to this problem, which had been largely ignored, and which is really serious if you are concerned about people's well-being and, for that matter, the healthcare costs that companies and governments are paying.
Because you mentioned in the book that I think the healthcare cost of Walmart in particular is about $500 million, and that's the cost they bear themselves, and obviously anyone looking at the bottom line starts thinking, right, how can we get rid of that? That's something that doesn't appear to have a return to it.
And healthcare costs, recently I've come across some statistics. The Centers for Disease Control says that 86% of the healthcare spend in the United States goes for chronic disease. Chronic disease comes mostly from stress. Stress comes mostly from work. And the healthcare costs crisis around the world, which the World Economic Forum has documented, it's the same thing. Most healthcare spend is on chronic disease. Chronic disease comes from stress and the individual behaviors such as smoking and drinking and overeating that stress causes. And so if we are serious about reducing healthcare costs and making people's lives better, we need to look at the workplace. After all, I have a quote in the book, which is one of my favorites. We got Bob Chapman, who's the CEO of this interesting manufacturing conglomerate, Barry Waymiller, and Bob says, according to the Mayo Clinic, the person you report to at work is more important for your health than your family doctor. And that has to be true, given, workplaces are important environments. We spend a lot of time at work. Work is a major source of stress in many people's lives. And if we want to fix the healthcare cost crisis, we need to fix the workplace.
Yeah, the number one killer of males still remains heart attacks. That's right. And we can presume that that's stress-related.
Absolutely.
And tell me this, because obviously in the US, firms are bearing the healthcare costs. Outside of the US, in the UK, we have the NHS. The costs of healthcare remain important, but they're sort of born in a different way. So we don't have it on the same agenda because firms aren't necessarily trying to offload it. How do you see the differences?
Well, I think it makes it a lower priority for the firms, but actually it makes it a higher priority for the country. I if you were to say to me, what's going to change this? It is going to be a country, possibly the UK, which has a nationalized health system that is going to say to employers, we're tired of you basically taking your social pollution, just like they used to do their environmental pollution, and just dumping it, and us having to pay to clean it up. So the UK, they, if you look at the Health and Safety Executive, which is the UK's equivalent to OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they have reports. And there's been lots of reports in the UK on the percentage of workdays that are lost due to stress, and they're high, the number of total workdays lost due to stress, and they're high, and the 1.1 million, which is, I think, a figure I remember, of people who are suffering from, you know, health-related workplace stress, work stress-related health issues in the UK. And so if I were to say, where is this going to change first, I would actually think the UK is high on my list. There are people like Sir Michael Marmot, the famous British epidemiologist. There are people like Dame Carol Black, who has been very active in these issues. The UK has done a bunch of reports and a bunch of studies. Where the UK is at the moment is they have documented the extent of the problem quite well with the Health and Safety Executive. There's been committees and documents and reports, and what there hasn't yet been is any regulatory action given.
But what would they change? Would they regulate working hours? Because you mentioned in the book that we treat people in a way that we couldn't get away with treating animals. But what would we? How would regulation look here?
I'm not sure. I think so. But if you said to me, you know, I want to put in a good regulatory regime, I would do it almost exactly the same way we've done for, you know, environmental pollution, such as, you know, carbon dioxide or particles in the air. So if I say to you, you know, you've released too much particulate matter into the air, and people are dying because you released all this particulate matter, you need to get the particulate matter out of the air. How you do it will be up to you, and you can use the most efficient technology you want, and you can do it in the most effective way you want, but at the end of the day, you can't be making people sick from stuff that you put in the air or the water. I would say exactly the same thing here. We know how to measure the health effects of workplaces. Number one, there is a single item measure of self-reported health. How healthy do you feel on a 5 or 9 point scale? And that item, that one item, has been found to prospectively predict both mortality and morbidity, even when you statistically control for people's current health status and many of their biometric markers, even when you statistically control for other things, and it's been found to be reliable for various populations, including the young, the old, the various ethnic and racial groups, etc. So I would say, and secondly, that's one measure. I'll give you another measure. What is your use of psychotropic drugs? As I say in the book, which you probably read, you know, I have a friend who went to work for Salesforce. She said, 1 week later, I went on antidepressants. It turns out all my friends are on antidepressants. If you go to the Silicon Valley, where I'm sitting right now, the Silicon Valley is awash in psychotropics. It's both legal and illegal. It is awash in antidepressants, ADHD drugs. It is awash in cocaine. The drug problem is enormous, and everybody kind of sees it. Nobody wants to do anything about it. So I would say, okay, Mr. or Ms. Employer, we are going to measure, and we can talk about how to do that in a minute. We are going to measure self-reported health, and norm you against, what's considered to be good, as we would for anything else. We're going to measure the extent to which your population uses various forms of psychotropics, which indicate, because when people are in pain in the workplace, psychological pain, they are going to medicate themselves through antidepressants, through alcohol, through a variety of other things. And we're going to hold you responsible for figuring out how to improve the health and well-being. Gallup Healthways measures well-being on 5 dimensions. I mean, we know how to measure this stuff. And so I'm going to hold you responsible for improving the physical and psychological well-being of the people who are working for you. And you are going to figure out the best way to do it, given your particular business. And I'm not going to tell you how to do it, but I'm going to tell you that your objective is to, just as I'm not going to tell you how to get the pollution out of the water, but you do it in whatever way you're going to find the most cost effective and that works given your particular business and your particular population.
I fully understand the objective there. You tell this vivid story about, I picture it as like an ice cream van, but I suspect it's more like an ambulance, but this van that travels between tech firms in the valley, going to deal with immediate emergency remedial action on patients who otherwise protest that they're too busy to go and seek help from doctors. So in the first instance, quite often this harm that people inflict upon themselves, certainly in high income jobs,
they're complicit, right?
Correct. They are complicit because of the pressures they are feeling from their employers. So let me give you another analogy, and maybe you can come up with the answer, in which case we're going to have the world's most successful podcast, but maybe the British government will knight you like they've knighted Sir Michael Marmot and Dame Carol Black. So let me give you another analogy, and you are certainly correct. One of the things that you've said, which is exactly right, is that this is not a problem that afflicts only low-paid people. This actually affects high-paid people. Engineers, doctors, physician burnout is an enormous problem in the U.S., I suspect in the U.K. also. Lawyers, huge problem in the United States. I don't know if you've read the New York Times article, The Lawyer, The Addict, which is a story of Peter Zimmerman and his dying from an infection that's associated with drug use. His widow, Eileen Zimmerman, who I know is writing a book about this, went to the American Bar Association, and we're going to get back to exactly the point in 1 second. She went to the American Bar Association, and she said, my husband, ex-husband actually, died of this infection. I'm kind of interested in understanding problems of, you know, stress in the workplace with lawyers. So you go to the American Bar Association, and you can find that they have a committee on alcoholism in the, alcoholism among lawyers. And they have a committee about drug addiction, about lawyers. And you go to the American Bar Association, and they have all kinds of data. So they can tell you, and the percentages are enormous, the percentage of lawyers that are alcoholics, the percentage of lawyers that are on drugs, the percentage of lawyers that are on both alcoholics and drugs. They can tell you the toll. They can point to you, we have the American Bar Association Committee on Alcohol Abuse in the Profession. We have the Committee on Drug Abuse in the Profession. We have committees, we have workplaces, we have working groups, we have reports, we have press releases, we have everything. We have everything except any attempt to stop it. Any attempt to say to the law firms, you are going to be responsible for fixing this problem. So we study the problem, we measure the problem, we examine the problem, we write reports about the problem, but we do not hold the work environments that are creating this problem responsible for doing anything about it.
Let's talk about how we might draw attention to this. You wanted league tables and reports of the worst firms?
Because I just worry, you mentioned sort of Glassdoor is easily gamed, and I think I would just be worried, knowing the competitive edge to these things, that companies might try to game the system.
Yes. If I had a perfect answer for this, I'd be smarter than I am. I mean, here's the story. I'm having a struggle with this with somebody else at the moment. The first thing you're going to do to fix the problem is you're going to, number one, recognize its scope. The second thing to fix the problem is you are going to pass or say to people who are in a position to fix the problem, you need to do something. You and I, lovely as we may be, you're not in a position to do anything. I mean, so if Twitter, heaven forbid, had an unhealthy workplace, you can't do much about it. Twitter needs to do something about it. If a law firm has an enormously high percentage of its lawyers that are, you know, on various forms of substances to try to, deal with the stresses and pressures that they're feeling, then it's up to the law firm to fix it. You can't go to the people and say, stop taking the drugs.
I guess the other thing is that sometimes we see these gestures by firms. So we see these gestures by firms saying that we've got no limit to the amount of vacation we have. And that often doesn't translate into people taking lots of vacation, but rather sort of performatively taking very little of it.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And one of the reasons why, so the question is not, The question is not, do I tell you that you can take as much vacation as you want? You know, as I talked to somebody a few weeks ago, I said, your place has a gym. He said, yes, if anybody actually used the gym, they'd be fired. People would say, why do you have all this time to be spending in our gym? So the same thing is here. You know, the question is not, do we make things available? But have we created a culture, an organizational culture, in which people feel responsible for the well-being of the people who work for them? Have we created a culture in which the people who work in that organization feel empowered, in every sense of the word empowered, to do what is necessary to take care of themselves? Have we created a place where people actually feel that health is a priority, health and well-being is a priority?
Yeah. And there's a gender split to this, right, in terms of the impact. I think one of the things you mentioned was men put up with stress, whereas women don't.
I don't have, like, great data on this, but my anecdotal impression from talking to a bunch of people and from listening to who's interested in this issue and for who's involved in the health and well-being industry, et cetera, is that women, I think, are much more interested in fixing the problem. Men want to macho through. They want to believe that they're going to be okay, you know, that it's that I can put up with anything and that, I'm tough enough to get through with it. And so, yes, I would say there is probably some, at least my anecdotal evidence suggests that there's a gender difference. Women want to fix the problem. Men want to drop dead from it.
I guess then one thing that I definitely did see you talking about is that the machismo that's often used, which is saying if you quit, it's because you weren't good enough for it. And so there's machismo to discourage people from resigning. And I wanted to look at another lens on it, and that's long hours. You talk about there's no benefit of long hours. Would your view be to regulate long hours, or just to, because you mentioned that people like having autonomy. My fear about regulating long hours is you remove that autonomy from people.
Well, I won't tell you when to work. I'll just tell you how long in total to work. I think attempts to regulate hours have not worked very well, but that's because in many instances they haven't been enforced very well. Again, the question is, what is the culture we've created? So one of the stories I tell a story in the book is the head of HR for Patagonia. And when the head of HR for Patagonia used to work for Sears, the department store chain, he got a email one day on the Christmas Eve at about 4, and replied the next day, which of course would be Christmas Day at about 9 in the morning. And the response was, what took you so long? And I said to him, when I interviewed him, I said, well, what happened if somebody did that in Patagonia? And he said, well, we'd fire them. So a lot of this is not about just regulation, which will do something but doesn't do everything. A lot of this are the expectations and the cultures that are created. So what do you do when you've got managers or leaders sending emails to their employees at all hours of the day and night and expecting responses? So one is you can regulate that. The other is you can, as a company, say, this is intolerable behavior, and if you behave this way, you're not going to work for us. We'll send you to work for one of the competitors. You can make our competitors' employees sick. So a lot of this is around what the managers do. So SAS Institute, the largest privately owned software company in the world, they have 35-hour, 40-hour work week. Jim Goodnight, the CEO of SAS, goes home at a reasonable hour. The expectation is that you are going to be able to deal with your family, demands in a healthy and good way, which is one of the reasons why they have a high proportion of women working for them. Patagonia measures what percentage of the women working for Patagonia return to Patagonia after they have a baby, and for Patagonia it's 99%. So you can do things to say, have I created a family-friendly workplace? How do we know that? I got working mothers here. If I say I have family-friendly work policies, how do I know that? Because I have nobody with families working here. I mean, you can see the contradiction. So there are things that you can do, but a lot of this is around the culture that you have created, the expectations you've created on what your people should do and how they should take care of themselves, and what is the expectation for how the organization is going to help those people live their lives and deal with the problems that they encounter.
I get the sense overall, and I don't know whether this is when I've scribbled this down, I don't know whether this is something you hinted at or whether it's my interpretation, but it's the idea that maybe the employer-employee relationship until now has been a bit of a hoax, in the sense that there's been lip service paid to creating good environments. But if you look at the stress that people are experiencing and the demands upon people, often that relationship hasn't been as benign as maybe it's been projected. Is that your view?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think you know, people say it's kind of like, you know, the reports for the American Bar Association. I mean, you know, so companies have spent a lot of time doing engagement surveys. You look at the Gallup data, engagement is hideous. You know, you look at the Edelman trust barometer, trust in leaders is bad. You know, so companies have spent a lot of time measuring stuff and talking about stuff and appointing people to look at stuff and worrying about stuff, etc. But they haven't done anything to fix most of the problems. So yes, the employee, you know, people are our most important asset, you know, is something that everybody says, and very few people actually implement in terms of how they manage their workplaces on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, because that sort of brings us on to power.
Here's the conflict I'm wrestling with. On one hand, you've written this book telling people not to make the mistake of being nice at work and working out how to win by sort of playing games. And on the other hand, when firms aren't genuinely kind-hearted and altruistic, you've taken them to task for not being nice to people.
And I guess, you know, one of the things in related to your book Power is the notion that, well, sometimes being nice is a naive strategy to adopt. That, you know, niceness has a penalty to it.
I think that's, you know, that's a perceptive comment. I think that could be part of it. I think the people who rise to the top in many organizations in today's world, not the world we might want, but the world that currently exists, are people who are nastier, tougher, more willing to work harder, more willing to do whatever it takes than their competition. I mean, you see this in sports. I'm not sure this is healthy, but it is the way it is. You know, if I want to be, you know, the world's best tennis player, or certainly the world's best soccer, or, you know, rugby or whatever player, one of the ways I have to be able to do that is I have to be able, in some sense, I need to have, obviously, a bunch of technical skills. I need to be more committed than my competition. I need to be able to, in some sense, take more punishment, to run harder, to play through pain, to use the famous phrase. And so I'm not sure that that's completely healthy, but that is certainly what generates success in many aspects of contemporary life.
And so the premise of Power is we often like to believe that the world is fair, despite all of the evidence that it isn't fair. And it's about prevailing once you understand that unfairness. Is that right?
Yep. I think you need to look at the world as it is, not as you would want it to be, and understand why, you know, understand why Donald Trump is president.
So I was chatting to a friend of mine who teaches an MBA program in London, and he said to me, he said to me, the book's become incredibly important in MBA classrooms, the study of power. And firstly, do you feel that the rules have changed since you wrote that book?
Nope.
There's books now sort of trying to jump on the back of it, talking about new power and trying to move that along. But do you still feel those rules still apply?
Oh, you mean, are you thinking of Henry Timms and the book New Power?
Yeah.
Oh, I know Henry very well. I mean, he and I have joked about this. I said, you wrote a book called New Power. I said, Donald Trump is president of the United States. Erdogan is president of Turkey. You've got the strong man running Hungary, and, you know, you got a strong guy running Poland. You've got, you know, now an emperor for life in China. I said, New Power exists only one place, which is in the pages of your book.
So you feel that
This idea of democratization, give me a break. I mean, you know, there are foundations that measure the extent to which of, you know, democratization around the world. Democracy is going backwards, unfortunately, which is very depressing. But, you know, you see strong people, you see these strong men, they're often men, almost always men, taking over in countries all over the world. You see minority rights getting, abused. You see people turning their back on immigrants. You see, you know, whatever. And actually, what you mostly see is that Donald Trump has been a perfect example. Donald Trump has taken the instruments of new power and used it fabulously. And, you know, to create power for himself. And, you know, and you see, we have all these tech companies. What is true about virtually every tech company in the world? Certainly true for Facebook, certainly true for Google. I don't know if it's true for Twitter, but it could be. They have supermajority voting stock. You know, so the only reason why Travis Kalanick is still not running Uber is that he basically didn't want to fight to stay. Had Travis wanted to stay, he'd still be running Uber because he had supermajority voting shares, which are quite typical. So we talk about democracy. There's no democracy in corporate boards. Google has special voting shares, which give the founders supermajority voting rights. And Mark Zuckerberg has supermajority voting rights. I've had friends in the corporate governance field who have written, you know, articles and books about this, about how, you know, the Silicon Valley is all this new power stuff, except all the companies are governed by very old power rules.
Right. Got it. Could you just talk to me briefly about the relationship between like a soft skill, like likability and the relationship between that and power? Because you see people trying to present themselves as likable. And I was interested in the relationship there.
Well, it's always nice to be liked. But in the words of my dear friend Robert Cialdini, the very, very famous social psychologist, before you demonstrate that you're likable, the first thing you probably need to demonstrate is you're competent and efficacious. Susan Fiske and Amy Cuddy have done studies over the years that looked at the fundamental dimensions of social judgment, and we judge people basically along two dimensions, warmth and competence, or likability and agency, or something like that. So number one, are you likable? Are you friendly? Are you nice? Number two, can you get stuff done? Are you competent? Are you agentic, etc.? And while it is conceptually true that people can be both warm and competent, empirically, the research sense suggests that people see likability and competence as negatively related. Amy Cuddy wrote this amazing Harvard Business School article. The article is relatively short. The title is fabulous. Just because I'm nice, don't assume I'm dumb. And there it is. You know, the theory being that, you know, if you're nice, it must be because you have to be. And if you're any damn good, you would be not as nice. And so we see niceness and competence as negatively related. And so what Cialdini would recommend to people is, you know, once you demonstrate your competence and efficacy, then when you are nice and warm, people say, wow, considering how smart Bruce is, he's really a nice guy. Or in the words in which I quote in my book, Power, Why Some People Have and Others Don't, a quote from the late Israeli Prime Minister, Golda Meir, don't be so modest, you're not that good.
Okay, because toughness is often perceived as intellect. I think I saw you talking about people who write horrible book reviews. People might presume they're unpleasant, but they do presume they're more intelligent.
Yeah. Yep.
Fascinating. Tell me this, the final thing I wanted to ask you about was with regards to sort of the notion of leadership authenticity and just what your take of is on that, just how those things transfer. We hear a lot of talk about authentic leadership now, and I just wondered whether that was an honest thing or how those things worked with some of the themes that you've discussed.
Well, Professor Herminia Barra, who used to be at INSEAD but now teaches at London Business School, has a fabulous YouTube video, which I think I've tweeted and linked in about, and has talked about this. Basically, to summarize it in a sentence and to oversimplify a very complicated argument that Herminia has made, you know, authenticity is basically an excuse for not changing. So, you know, say, you know, Bruce, you need to change. No, no, I'm just being my authentic self. I think people need to be authentic, but I think they're authentic to the wrong thing. You do not need to be authentic to yourself. You need to be authentic to what the human beings around you need from you. So let's say you're running a company, or let's say you're running a unit in a company, and you got people working for you, and they are looking to you, obviously, for intellectual leadership and for your energy and for your concern and your compassion. And let's say you've had some catastrophic disaster in your personal life, your significant other has left you, or your child has, God forbid, committed suicide or something. Which is actually a true story I had a friend of mine face, and you come to work. They, you know, on the one hand, they would like to know about your problems, and they would like to be, you know, sympathetic, at least up to a point and for a while. But at the end of the day, you need to be authentic to what they need from you. They need your energy. They need your concern. They need your attention. And they really, at the end of the day, it's hard to say this, but it's true. They really, at the end of the day, don't really care about what you're feeling and what you're going through. And so you need to be authentic, not so much to you and your feelings. Oh, I'm miserable. I'm depressed. I'm this. You need to be authentic to what the people around you need from you. If they need energy, you need to show up with energy. If they need concern and compassion, you need to show them concern and compassion. If they need, you know, direction and attention and whatever they need, your job as a leader is to be engaged with and available to the people who are working with and for you in ways that help them to do their job and to feel valued and all this other stuff. And you have to do that if you're running 101 degree Fahrenheit temperature, if you've had issues, if you're exhausted, whatever. So great leaders are great actors. They are able to put on a show, not on how they are feeling, but on how they need to project to the people around them, how they want them to be seen.
Do you think, does it work the other way? So does authenticity have a value and sort of bringing your full self to work have a value for team members but not for leaders? Or is it all an illusion in your view?
I think you need to, you know, I mean, so there was a guy named Ren Zephyropoulos who years ago did a video for Harvard Business School and famous case, Ren and Fred. Anyway, Ren Zephyropoulos said something which I think is right. He said, your parents, or mostly your parents, he said, your parents will love you unconditionally. He said, your boss at work is not going to love you unconditionally. Work relationships are different. At work, the question is, you know, what can you do? What are you doing? What is the contribution that you're making? So you can bring your full self to work, but I think what you really ought to bring to work is the thing that your boss needs and wants from you. You know, I've heard to take an example, Tony Hayward, the former CEO of BP, I do not think did himself any favors when he was testifying and said, you know, basically, I want my life back. He may have wanted his life back. That was his true authentic self. I mean, he had to show up as somebody, you know, dedicated to fixing the problems that BP was facing with the Gulf oil spill. And he had to show up with energy and he had to show up with enthusiasm. And even if he didn't feel it, you have to sometimes put on a show.
So this Elon Musk stuff in the last 2 weeks where he's sort of crying and saying that 120-hour work weeks have crushed him, do you think that's an unnecessary distraction?
Well, Elon Musk, first of all, is a wonderful example of dying for a paycheck. I mean, you know, one of the things we know is that sleep is important. Elon Musk is a walking example of sleep deprivation. But beyond that, I don't think anybody has that much sympathy for him. I mean, you know, you need to act like a leader. And if one of the things that will help you act like a leader is you get sufficient rest, you know, and don't take too many various kinds of drugs. And, you know, then you'll be much better off.
Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat is brought to you in association with The Joy of Work, the new book by me, Bruce Daisley. Now, some of the themes that Jeffrey Pfeffer has talked about here, about stress, about people feeling burnt out, are the themes that start The Joy of Work. But it goes a lot further than that. There's 30 ways that you can improve the impact of work on you. And some of that is making your team laugh more and be more closely connected. There's a lot of practical suggestions that I think you're going to find really compelling. The Joy of Work is available now as a pre-order. You can order it from Amazon or Waterstones today. Pre-order The Joy of Work today.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit UH1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Thank you for listening. As ever, the best way to stay in touch with the show is to subscribe on Apple Podcasts. But you can also listen to us on Stitcher or on Spotify. We're on sort of all the places. All of the episodes are up on the website, which is eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. And you can follow us on Twitter or connect to me on LinkedIn. See you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.